Thank you. It's great to see you all here today, especially on this rainy Saturday afternoon. Before I start, I just want to acknowledge that we're on Coast Salish territories today, and to acknowledge the many nations in the Coast Salish in this area who use these lands traditionally and continue to do so today. I'm Quagil from the Kokwakiwak Nation from Fort Rupert, Northern Vancouver Island, and I'm a visitor here, so I just want to acknowledge that. And thank the Coast Salish peoples. So today I'm going to talk about, first of all, here we go. I want to sort of start by talking a big picture about representations of Indigenous people, both historically and today, as we talk about decolonizing media and kind of strategies. So the questions we were asked to think about were, what are the media challenges facing minority cultural groups? And what are the strategies for making media space in a Eurocentric environment? So I'm going to kind of blend those two together as I go. And I'm going to not give a formal paper, but just kind of talk a bit about my own perspective. So I'm currently a PhD student at Simon Fraser University, and I look at law and violence in First Nations communities in BC. I also contribute to the blog Media Indigena, and have been doing so for the last few years. Media Indigena is has contributors from across Canada, so there's 10 of us, and we all have different backgrounds and perspectives and write on diverse issues on that website, so I'll be talking a little bit about that as I go. So just to think of big picture, what we're talking about when we're thinking about Indigenous peoples and representations of us. To say that Indigeneity, I just want to start by saying Indigeneity is all about local, place-based knowledge, which is practiced within a set of relations that change through time and space. So when we're talking about Indigenous people, we're talking about our histories and cultural practices, as well as political perspectives, which are relational, active, and have been alive in these lands for thousands of years. So talking about a very diverse group of communities, which, as we'll see, have, or as we know, has been displaced by kind of ideas about Indians or kind of pan-Indigenous ideas that we see in the media that don't make reference necessarily to the diversity of First Nations experiences. So colonial ideas about Indians, on the other hand, are new to these lands. Displacing Indigenous ways of being in favor of colonial ones has entailed both ideological and physical violence, which is embedded in and enforced by Canadian law, such as in the Indian Act. So in order to know how to treat Indians in the Indian Act, we had to first know how to frame and to think about Indians, this idea. So inherent in this idea is an expectation of violence, either against us or perpetrated by us, and that includes seeing us as a dying race, and some of the images I have up there from the film In the Land of the Headhunters, for example, and some of the anthropological images were taken because it was supposed to represent this kind of past-oriented dying people. So these ideas about us as violent subjects or subjects of violence help to legitimize state intervention into our lives and really dehumanizes us so that there's only, you know, when we see images of Indigenous people in the media, it often kind of feeds off and perpetuates these ideas. So we can see that representing Indians within racist colonial terms was central to the creation and imposition of a settler society. How we're seen has been shaped by the early anthropological movies I've talked about, as well as newspapers, photographs, books, and so on, created by others, not by Indigenous people. And the representations we make and have always made of ourselves, such as through art and stories, have been dismissed as non-legitimate forms of knowledge or truth, unless validated by non-Native experts. So this dynamic of delegitimizing Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous people's experiences and worldviews lies at the heart of our struggles of representation today that I'm going to talk about. I have a couple images there, and I'll talk a little bit about that after, from the Paul Frank powwow party celebrating Fashion Night Out in New York City. So just wanted to sort of make the link between how the historical representations and then how today in kind of consumer culture, one of the other strategies is to make our cultural knowledge and symbols just something else that you can buy and kind of devoid of the original meaning that it has. So these ideas are prevalent in mainstream media's inclusion of Indigenous people, both ignoring us and the problems that we actually want attention given to, and in how Indigenous people's lives are portrayed when they are included. So my work has been around violence for quite a long time, and when I was in my undergrad in the late 90s, I sort of was looking for coverage on violence in the lives of Indigenous communities, particularly girls and women, and just noticed there was really a lack of coverage, a lack of writing that had been done. And since that time, a lot of work has gone on into trying to gain recognition of the violence against us. But sort of what has that accomplished? What has that led to? So gaining recognition does take a lot of work, and there's been a lot of community efforts across the province and nationally to gain attention to, for example, violence against Indigenous girls and women. But even when visibility is achieved, there's limitations as to how that violence can be understood. So certainly the coverage of violence faced by girls and women, particularly in BC, has changed over the years. It's largely fleeting, and that fleeting nature is part of continued dehumanization, I would argue, so that it's just normalized now. You just see, you know, girl goes missing, oh, another girl's dead. We hear about it for a day, and then we don't hear about it again. So the kind of uproar that happens when other kinds of violence takes place just doesn't happen. So we don't see a sustained interest, and it's just become part of how we see Indigenous girls and women is as subjects of violence, and that's just accepted. So there has been, as I said, a rise in visibility, particularly around the missing girls and women, both from Vancouver as well as in northern BC and nationally. So we have this language to talk about the missing women. We have images that come to mind around that. But what changes have really come from that? So in the case of northern BC, and just that whole area of the province largely remains out of the minds of most Canadians. In those communities, family members advocated for many years for attention to be given to the girls that were going missing, and did community marches and other things. And it was only when a tree planter, a non-Native young woman, went missing that the public became aware of the fact that girls were being targeted in this area. So finally there was media coverage, media attention that was given. And so now they have the phrase the Highway of Tears to talk about Highway 16 in that area. So even though we now have that language and we have this awareness, we know that it's happening, when girls go missing and they continue to go missing and or are murdered on Vancouver Island, we had a couple girls just a few years ago, about a month apart, that again it was in the media for a day and then you just don't hear about it again. So even when that visibility is achieved, it doesn't really change how we understand the stories of Indigenous people's lives. The other example is in the case of, more recently in the news of Burns Lake, where, as some of you may have seen, where John Furlong was accused of physical abuse during his time working in that area. And despite the piece in the Georgia Strait that broke that story, it really just gave Furlong, in the end, an opportunity to rally people around him to reinforce his credibility, and then it disappeared. So we haven't really heard anything about it since then. And I have that was one of the sort of images that we saw a lot of him, a lot of the coverage focused on him and how could people do this to him, and the kind of subject that he was, as opposed to hearing very much. We heard a little bit from some of the people in Burns Lake, but not very much. So what remains a challenge for us in making space for Indigenous people in the media, as I've been saying, is the ability to be fully humanized, given the normalization of violence that we face. So, and in the end, as people are fighting for visibility and for recognition of these issues, now that we have this language to talk about it, it really hasn't resulted in any changes in the level of violence, the acceptability of that violence, or really how violence as it happens is responded to now. Part of the impact of the coverage, I would argue, around a lot of the violence against girls and women has been that Indigenous women become marked by that violence instead of the perpetrators. So in the case of Picton, for example, even though he was a white guy, it's not as though now all white guys are marked by that violence. It's the Indigenous women who continue to be marked either through their victimization or to be blamed for the violence they face. So it doesn't really end up making people more empathetic towards the women or changing how we see them or wanting to know about their full lives. It just sort of reinforces what people already think about them. So underlying all of this is that most representations of Indigenous people continue to deny our agency and voice. We continue to be understood not as Kwakiwak or Lekwungen or our, within our many nations, but more on terms of the sort of pan-Indian categories that have been imposed through colonialism in the first place. So making interventions to ensure our voices are heard take creativity and big, loud, insistent efforts, and we see things like blockades or other actions that are happening, for example, in northern BC in the pipeline resistance. I think that those actions do become visible in their way of reminding people that in BC, the lands remain unceded, that there are very few treaties that have been signed, and that Indigenous communities are still thriving and living our traditions and our ways of life. But blockades don't happen for the kind of daily violence that's become accepted against girls and women. So in terms of strategies for making media space for Indigenous voices, and I'd like to just, I think, go back to that original idea I was talking about of indigeneity as place-based knowledge, forming a network across the lands that we live in, and that one way to gain visibility and create space in media is through asserting ourselves on our own terms. So magazines like Redwire and Spirit Magazine that are really focused on Indigenous communities speaking to other Indigenous youth, other Indigenous communities, and defining for ourselves what our stories are, what's important to us, and how we want to tell those stories. And instead of trying to gain legitimacy and gain attention in mainstream media or to shape ourselves so that we fit into what other people are going to see as legitimate, to redefine that on our own terms. So part of that, I think, is there are programs in communities at a community level to do video projects with youth, to try to raise the capacity of youth to tell their own stories, and that people want to hear those stories. And that might not mean attention nationally or even provincially or within their town. It might be in their own small community that they're showing a video to local elders, to their family members, and that's where those conversations can start to be had about who we are. And to look at, you know, a lot of the videos that are being made are around really pressing issues like violence, but they're done in a way that starts a conversation about how that's linked to historical issues, and not just focusing on the victimization, but on the bigger picture of how that fits into a lot of other community issues. So I think that there can also be a real broader impact felt from those efforts. And one of the cases, just going back to those images I showed from the Frank Paul powwow party that some of you might have heard of more recently, was when two Indigenous women, Adrienne Kay and Jessica Metcalf, who have blogs Native Appropriations and Beyond Buckskin, they wrote letters and got attention through their blogs of the inappropriateness of the Fashion Week party, and that had a ripple effect of the president of the Paul Frank company inviting them to speak with him and really taking action based on their recommendations. So they took all of the images of what that had, like Native designs, out of their catalog. They wanted the bloggers to meet with the sort of marketing board that they're a part of, and went much farther beyond just the readership that they had for their blogs, but was actually taken seriously within that company. And hopefully that'll have a larger effect as well. So I think we can encourage more of this, as I said, by raising the capacity of community members to tell their stories. And I think that the important thing, in my perspective, is going back to how we understand Indigenous people and communities, so that we are trying to restore an understanding of ourselves in a holistic kind of way, as whole people, not just the kind of sensationalist stuff that we see in the media. And that the conversation amongst Indigenous people is a good place to start. And I think, like Media Indigena, since I've been writing for them, it's been really fantastic to see that there's a large readership of Indigenous people online that are responding and having conversations, and other, you know, non-Indigenous people as well, but that's not necessarily the focus. Not necessarily speaking in a language that's gonna get the attention of more mainstream audience, but that's gonna foster more dialogue within our own communities. So I also had a have a poster there from Imaginative Film Festival, which just ended in Toronto, and that is an international Indigenous film festival that has been going for quite a number of years and has really fantastic programming. And so I think that's where I'll leave it for now until we have questions after. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So I prefer to sit, if that's okay. And I've got a slideshow presentation as well, but it's not in order. I'm going to just tell you to kind of jump all over the place. You can see the side slides, right? The icons.
No, it's kind of goes.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sorry. Well, we'll struggle. Okay. So I'd like to start by also acknowledging we're on the Coast Salish land, and that I'm in a long line of uninvited guests on this land, and I make the acknowledgement as a tiny step towards countering the denial of Canada as a settler state. My bio is in the program, but I just want to highlight I wear different hats in my work on media, and two are more relevant to my talk today. I facilitate Tricon Vancouver, which is a political and social unfunded organization representing about 145 South Asian lesbians, gays, bisexual, transgender queers in the Lower Mainland. So my first hat is as a media spokesperson for Tricon Vancouver. And we're an immigrant population in the sense that all our members are seen as outsiders to Canada, whether we're immigrants, refugees, first, second, third or fourth generation Canadian. But we are, however, outsiders in Canada and migrants in that Canada is a settler land. What I sometimes call a neo-Europe on Indigenous land. The other hat I wear is as a journalist in alternative media, and Kinesis and Extra West are mentioned in the blurb in the program. Kinesis was Canada's national feminist newspaper, but I've also worked with this magazine, Pacific Current. I take photos for Vancouver Media Co-op and so on. And my scholarly work, I'm doing a PhD now, and of course it focuses on the relationship between alternative media and social movements. And it's from that experience that I derive my media literacy and analysis in this presentation. So Vancouver, as you know, has a large South Asian population that dates back more than a century. As of 2001, 76% of South Asians in Vancouver were Punjabi or of Punjabi origin. And for the most part, the Vancouver media uses the term Indo-Canadian or South Asian almost interchangeably. But largely to refer to Punjabi and Punjabi Sikh people. In other words, we're all seen as a monolithic group with identical histories, languages, cultures, and so on. I want to clarify that Tricon and my use of the term refers to queers born in South Asia, Canada, or other countries whose ethnic heritage can be traced back to Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Burma, the Maldives, Nepal, Pakistan and Sri Lanka. And our membership is in fact made up with people from ancestry from all those places. So maybe go to the next slide. So I want to talk about Vancouver, the role that Vancouver's mainstream media plays in constructing queer and so-called immigrant communities as oppositional communities, divided by hate. Actually, that's not the slide I wanted, but I don't know where it is, but it's okay. It carries the same message. So how queers of color, that is racialized, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people, get erased in this construction, and how immigrant communities get portrayed in addition to being culturally and irremediably patriarchal and sexist, as culturally and irremediably homophobic. And also what these media constructions and discourses do and enact within Vancouver's queer communities, how it contributes to what is being talked about in academic circles as homonationalism. And it's a term to some extent is describing what Trico in Vancouver has had to deal with. And I'll get back to that term. There are three key notions I want to touch on to contextualize my talk. And one is that culture in newspaper discourse essentially replaces what was historically constructed as racial difference. This has been termed culturalism by Dr. Thavani, and some of you heard her, Sanara Thavani, yesterday, her talk at the opening, and by other scholars such as Imani Banerjee and Shireen Razak. So my first point is that culturalism as a form of racism propels the framing of South Asians, Muslims, or those perceived as Muslim, and other racialized people as inherently culturally homophobic. And by reducing the source of difference to the merely cultural, it enables violence to be framed as the result, of certain indigenous and non-Western traditions or religions, rather than of power relations of heterosexism or patriarchy. In this way, the homophobia we face as queers of color get constructed in both media and popular discourses as a consequence of the failure of racialized, queer, and straight communities to assimilate or adapt to white Western norms. That is, to adopt values of tolerance, diversity, and civility, which in Canada are seen as inherently and naturally, and in fact culturally, possessed by the white European Canadian. And this tends to be evoked most commonly by the phrase Canadian values. In my work on media, I look at culturalism by looking at the coverage of gay bashings in the mainstream media, and particularly from 2007 to 2010, in which we had a surge, according to Statistics Canada, of reportings of gay bashing. And the most high profile of which in the media tend to be the ones that got the most coverage, tend to be the ones perpetrated by South Asian men. I also look at coverage in the queer newspaper, Extra West. My interest is in how culturalism's framing of immigration populations not only establishes the differences that enable the Canadian national to imagine a social and shared national identity with other Canadians around these imagined Canadian values. And here that there's this conflation of nation and state that Dr. Thavani was talking about last night. But that the notion of the irremediably homophobic immigrant is essential to this, to the construction of this national identity. And so too is the partial inclusion of queers of color, which is required to establish the West's superior ability to tolerate differences. And my second notion is homonationalism, and it's a complex concept, but more simply, and what I'm taking from it today, is that it refers to a gay imperialism, a nationalistic racist discourse that posits queerness as a white Western phenomenon. Homonationalism draws on culturalism to present so-called immigrant communities as inherently culturally homophobic and as more and irremediably homophobic than white Western communities. In doing so, it props up the mythical notion of the West of whiteness as supportive of gay rights across the board, as liberated, progressive, and gay positive. So what we call Canadian values then has become the common sense way of invoking certain human qualities, like fairness, compassion, and caring, as inherently and naturally possessed by the white Canadian national. Of setting apart those who do not naturally possess these, and in so doing this constructs, and here I'm quoting Sanara Thavani again, communities as neatly bounded, separate cultural entities, untouched by the external factors within which their cultural practices take place, and people of color in Canada as the origin of difference. So the way out of this for us as immigrants is to strive to fit in, to assimilate, and to adopt those values as Canadian values. The phenomenon homonationalism is used to refer primarily to post-9/11 white gay politics that serves the interests of the state. and how sexuality or saving the gays has become another way, in addition to saving women from patriarchal men, that the West rallies public support for and justifications for example, interventions and imperialist incursions into Iraq or Afghanistan. Sandeep Roy, who is the founder of the umbrella organization to which Tricone Vancouver belongs, it's the original Tricone in San Francisco, which is about 35 years old, Sandeep Roy talks about how gay rights have become another marker in the distance between barbarism and civilization. And it's a marker that justifies further targeting of a perversely sexualized and racialized Muslim population who refuse to properly assimilate. We've also seen a form of homonationalism being used in the constructions of Israel as gay-friendly, what's known as pinkwashing, to justify the occupation of Palestinian lands. And there's a lot more to this homonationalist discourse and construction. And for the most part, it does focus on Islamophobia post 9/11. And Itwas will be talking more about Islamophobia. So my example is the example I chose today will focus on South Asian and specifically Punjabi Sikh coverage in Vancouver in the media. But the third notion that I want to point out is how media stories build on tropes or themes that are familiar to readers. The tropes reflect a kind of cultural knowledge that we already possess. And thus, it becomes a kind of shorthand or common sense knowledge that we, as the readers and viewers, are already assumed to believe or accept. Sarah gave us a synopsis of how certain tropes in the media construct indigenous people in ways that do violence to them. For my purposes, an example of what I mean is the frame of the perpetrator's race in news stories. A race, or its politically correct synonym, culture, when the gay basher is not white. So here the trope of cultural backwardness is attached to the mention of the perpetrator's race or culture. So when the perpetrator or gay basher is a racialized, non-Christian, non-white man, say a South Asian Sikh man, the common sense logic of cultural backwardness explains his hate speech. And in our heads we go, well, yes, of course. Conversely, the racial background of the perpetrator and the discourse of cultural backwardness are not the framing or tropes used in stories where the gay basher is a white Christian man. For example, culture or race was not mentioned when Richie Dowry was gay bashed at the Fountainhead in 2009 by a white man. And nor was it the trope deployed in the media coverage of Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his minority conservative government's unsuccessful 2006 motion to reopen parliamentary debates on same-sex marriage, nor in the 2007-2008 debates on same-sex marriage, a time in which we saw an intensification of homophobic rhetoric in the media, which incidentally was followed the next 2 years by a rise in reported gay bashings, according to Stats Canada. There was little to no coverage on the cultural backwardness of white Christian Canadian culture, nor was the trope of resistance to progress applied to Harper or to opponents of same-sex marriage in a racialized manner, although it was applied to opponents of same-sex marriage who were not white. And for example, a lot of the coverage focused on the Chinese Christian communities who were particularly targeted as key opponents of same-sex marriage here in Vancouver, despite Harper's much higher profile opposition. And again, in the policy struggles, we saw more recently in the Burnaby School District, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with. So in a study of the newspaper coverage of this debate on same-sex marriage, the author Sarah Bannerman argues that, and this is a quote, the same-sex marriage issue can be seen as a discursive struggle over values and over Canadian identity. She concludes that by June of 2004, the view that acceptance of same-sex marriage went along with Canadian values of tolerance and accommodation had become dominant in Canadian newspaper coverage of the issue. So this leads me to the main point I want to make before I go on to the example, In Sunera Thamani's book, Exalted Subjects, she writes that, and I quote, underneath the sanitized garb of a postmodern, multiracial, multi-ethnic, tolerant Canada beats the heart of a stubbornly colonial national formation, sharing a common imaginary with other white settler societies. So my studies have shown that media tropes haven't changed much, and actually Sarah talked about this too, haven't changed much since Confederation. Although they vary in form over time and space, and to whom they're applied and how. So historically, the tropes of natural white superiority versus the racial inferiority of the other, who was savage, backward, or resistant to progress, were applied to indigenous peoples. And it's only relatively recently, in the last century, that these tropes of the barbarian other have been extended to racialized citizens, immigrants, and newcomers to Canada. What's important here is that the roots of homo nationalism in a settler state like Canada is the historical sexual violence and terror against indigenous peoples in the making of this nation state. So as queers, we're increasingly being given certain rights in the nation. And increasingly, we're seeing queer discourses and by extension queer politics parrot other settler state discourses that mark others, indigenous and non-white people, as backward, unprogressive, and primitive. And in fact, Jasbir Poir, who coined the term homo nationalism, refers to queer organizations as settler formations. So I'm going to move on to the example, and I think it'll be in the next slide. Here's where it says struggle, two communities struggle with hate and the pitting of South Asian versus queer, but it's the next slide. Maybe not.
Do you know the number?
No, it might be the next. Yeah, this one. Okay, sorry about that. So on December 15, 2007, the opening line of the Vancouver Sun's cover story, which was titled Canada's Changing Moral Landscape, are immigrants to the country changing the face of what's considered right or wrong? It began with a quote. The opening line was, I hate homosexuality, says Balwant Singh Gill, a prominent leader in BC's large Sikh community. Most Sikhs believe, continuing the quote, homosexuality is unnatural and you can't produce kids through it. And secondarily, no major religion allows it. So that article was published 5 days after an action on December 10th, 2007, when almost 2,000 protesters, most of them Punjabi Sikhs, went to Vancouver Airport to block the Canadian government's deportation of Laibar Singh, who was a paralyzed refugee claimant from India. So coinciding with International Human Rights Day, that's December 10th, the protesters gathered at the airport and stopped his deportation by Canadian Border Services, which led the mainstream media a spate of coverage in mainstream media to lambaste the protesters for their illegal and violent behavior. Balwant Singh Gill's comment in The Sun 5 days later, I hate homosexuality, inevitably provoked an outcry among Vancouver's queers. As the facilitator, and you know, Vancouver is touted as one of the gay-friendliest cities in Canada. So the reaction was inevitable. As a facilitator of Tricon Vancouver, which at the time was the only organization serving South Asian queers, I expected phone calls from the media soliciting our reaction, as they do when a South Asian man gay-bashes. Only two came. One from Punjabi TV News, and the other was from Vancouver's queer newspaper, Extra West. The mainstream media overwhelmingly carried the voices of white queer community leaders who decried the South Asian community's culpability for all the homophobia in Vancouver. The fact that Balwant Singh Gill was the only South Asian quoted in a story on immigrant values demonstrates how the media frames communities of color as homogenized and monolithic. In fact, the words of The Sun's reporter blatantly frames it that way. He wrote, Gill, the spokesperson for 39 Sikh temples in British Columbia, appears to combine in one person many of the conservative and libertarian values that immigrants are bringing to and expressing in Canada. The values referred in the story have been defined by an Angus Reid poll that found immigrants hold different values. For example, only 17% of immigrants versus 19% of real Canadians hold middle-of-the-road views. The content of these values is not clear in the story. Whether a reader made it through the entire two full center spread broadsheet pages of the story, or just one page or half a page, the reporter's answer to the headline yes, no question, are immigrants the main reason British Columbians are losing their reputation as morally easygoing and freedom-loving, which is a quote from the story, is answered ultimately in the affirmative. What's also interesting is that the only other immigrant quoted in the story was an engineer who came to Canada from Hong Kong. Bill Chu likewise represented the voice of the entire Chinese community, which incidentally makes up 41% of Vancouver's population. Nowhere in the story do we learn that Gill's interpretation of the Sikh texts are not universally shared within the Punjabi Sikh community or the broader South Asian community, nor that Sikh texts do not allude to homosexuality at all. And there was no effort made to interview South Asian queers. Here, we appear as absent or invisible. So by pitting queers against South Asians, the media constructed these two communities as separate and monolithic, failing to take account, into account not only the intersections, that is that one can be both queer and South Asian, but also the alliances that exist among and between the two communities. It placed South Asian queers, such as the members of Tricon Vancouver, in a double bind. We understood all too clearly the perils of the racism versus homophobia trap set by the Sun. Yet it was difficult to ignore that the move by the media to publish the story at this particular time worked in the interests of a state openly angered by the failed deportation of Laibar Singh, which had been front page news all that week. So a prominent exception to this coverage was this 15-minute story on a popular Punjabi TV news show in Vancouver. It's now Omni, but it was called Punjabi TV News, and I actually forget the network, but the reporter was Dilbar Kang, and he explored various aspects of the story in 15 minutes, including the connection with the Laibar Singh case. The story consisted of juxtaposed interviews with Alan Herbert, a former gay city councillor, and myself representing Tricon Vancouver. Editorials condemning Balwant Singh Gill's comment on homosexuality were also broadcast on other South Asian media, such as Radio India, and All India Radio, which reaches a wide cross-section of South Asians in Vancouver. So ironically, the support for and visibility of South Asian queers in media that we call ethnic at this time was unprecedented. This was a watershed moment for Vancouver South Asian queers, and I believe it has a lot to do with the fact that South Asian queers who spoke out at this time did not distance ourselves from our South Asian communities, but rather spoke out against the intersections of racism and homophobia in the Sun's article. So in an interview with Vancouver's queer newspaper, Extra West, in January 2008, and I think there's a slide on this, probably next. One more. Sorry. The slide before, this was the story of talking about Laibar Singh. Right. But if we can move to the next. So, God, I hate that photo. So in this interview with Extra West, I repeated some of the same comments I'd made on Punjabi TV News. I condemned the homophobic comment by Gill, as well as the racist story in the Vancouver Sun, and explained the article's impact on South Asian queers, that by doing nothing to educate the public or even to acknowledge our existence as South Asian queers, the Sun had not only fueled racism against all of us as South Asians, but exacerbated the homophobia we face as South Asian queers. Extra West's story was titled Sikh Leaders' Anti-Gay Remarks Ignite Furor. Controversy highlights divisions in the queer community. The reporter goes on to identify these divisions as between those who say homophobia is the primary issue and others more focused on what they consider the racist response to Gill's comments. So this recalls the tropes used by the Sun in their story, and it ignores that the thrust of my comments had been to point out that the problem with this construction of queer versus people of color, and that racism is a divisive issue and not homophobia, had been to point out the problems with the construction of queer versus people of color, and pointing out that, and I was pointing out that racism is actually the divisive issue, not the homophobia, which affects us all as queers. So in the story, one white gay male community reader was, was quoted, and he was identified as community leader, was quoted proclaiming Gill's homophobic comment, a wake-up call to the queer community to recognize that other marginalized minorities are not automatically our friends and allies. If that minority holds devoutly and literally to just about any religious creed, be it Sikhism, Islam, Christianity, or Judaism, the odds are that they are not only not our friends, but are in fact a very real threat to our rights and freedoms. The reference to rights and freedoms loyally repeats the trope of the Canadian citizen under threat by freedom-hating outsiders to the nation. So in the same story, this actually there's a slide on this if you want to. Can get rid of this one. I think the next, try one more. Yeah, here. So in the same story, the community leader calls for an acknowledgement that the Sikh community has work to do to eradicate the homophobic intolerance that's part of their cultural construct. What's clear is that the notion of homophobic intolerance in the South Asian community was clearly defined as part of their cultural construct, rather than the result of a system of dominance and power that surfaces across cultures, communities, and nations. So following my comments in Extra West, Vancouver's queer opinion makers called a community meeting on December 21st, 2007, at which and it was a meeting to actually berate me for trivializing Gill's comment and condoning homophobia. The perception that I had chosen race over queer led some of the, at the meeting to suggest I had not been queer in a way acceptable to the dominant white queer community. The way in which this was framed by some of the queer people present was that I had turned my back on the goal of gay liberation, and in so doing, I had not stood up for Canadian values. So my point is, such accusations emerge from these either-or assumptions that pit race and queerness as distinct rather than intersecting and interlocking identities. There's a scholar in from Europe who's in California now, Fatima Al-Tayyab, who did a study of Muslim queers in Europe, and she writes about how queers of color are often confronted with the demand to take sides in the imaginary clash of cultures in which the West stands for liberal and progressive cosmopolitanism, and she documents the ways in which queers of color have been constantly, and this is a quote, constantly confronted with silencing, appropriation, exclusion, and the overwhelming demand to adapt their reality to ideologies proclaiming them as oxymorons. It can't be queer and South Asian. So in short, rather than looking at what had caused me to take the position I had in the media, that is, I'm a queer of color, my actions were interpreted at this meeting as a rejection of the commonsensical notion that the values of tolerance, diversity, and civility are intrinsically or birthright possessions of Canadians. Thus, my apparent rejection of these values cast me as un-Canadian. In other words, taking a position as a South Asian queer was seen as tantamount to a betrayal of my country, a country that posits itself as this progressive, forward-thinking, gay-positive nation. And I don't mean to homogenize Vancouver queers, because not everyone voiced this position, and Tricon Vancouver also had some very strong allies. But to wrap up the story, Gill apologized for his comments, and Tricon Vancouver won a Community Hero Award from Exeter West for our part in shifting the discourse. However, 9 months later, a white gay man, Jordan Smith, was assaulted by a South Asian man, and Vancouver was back to square one. We condemned the assault on Smith, but again were forced in the position of refuting the homogenizing charge that South Asians as a collective were responsible. And that story about communities divided by hate in the province was written at the time of the Jordan Smith gay bashing. So this example, I use this example to illustrate not only how the mainstream media uses anti-immigrant tropes to mobilize homo-nationalist discourse within Vancouver's queer community, but also how the queer media did so, reflecting that what we frame as a queer liberation struggle has in fact become a fight for citizenship entitlements and rights to national belonging. So I'm wrapping up, sorry. Queer liberation movements have in fact become a drive for lost privileges, and as such, they can only benefit those who face oppression on the basis of homophobia alone. They also serve to facilitate the assimilation of queers of color as racialized bodies into the Canadian nation. And consequently, we become further complicit in extending the neo-colonial or colonizing mission on Indigenous land. So the message of the frame is simple: the queer subject is under threat by immigrant others. And this is uncritically parroted by in the queer media. The message to South Asian and other racialized queers was that queers of all races can belong, and we can be part of the nation if we conform to a queer identity and a queer liberation that centralizes whiteness as national identity. In short, the path to our emancipation and belonging in the nation as queers of all races lies in joining a project of modern sexuality that requires us to break away from our traditional communities and to adopt individual identities as queers. So I'm just going to wrap up because I know I'm at the end of my
38
time.
38 minutes.
Sorry?
36.
You have 28 minutes.
Okay.
Sorry. So I think, I mean, the main point I'm trying to make in terms of alternative media is that we have to look at the way that our organizations, our social movement organizations, our movements and organizations and media are, in fact, settler formations, and that we, our work should be to dismantle the structures of racism and imperialism embedded within these so-called alternative structures to make visible the ways in which whiteness has become normalized within our activism and our discourse. And I'm just going to end there. Sorry, I'm way over time. Thank you.
Thank you, Fatima. And Sitrit?
Hey, everyone. I'm just going to wait for Ishaq to run my thing. Great, thanks. So to begin with, I'd also like to acknowledge and with respect that we are on unceded First Nations lands.
Sorry, we can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. So to begin with, I'd also like to acknowledge with respect that we are on unceded First Nations lands. And I also want to thank the organizers for pulling this panel together and for pulling these this last 2 days of events together. And I also want to say that I'm not Indra Prasht. I'm stepping in for her, who had to leave, had to be abroad this weekend. So I'm a student at the School of Communication at SFU, and my work, my doctoral work, looks at the idea of moral panics over Muslim bodies, which I know many of you will be able to recognize. Those are those moments of really intense media scrutiny, usually temporarily contained for a couple weeks, where everybody goes nuts over something to do with a Muslim body, whether it's a headscarf or a face veil or the mosque at Ground Zero or something about Muslim presence. So that's sort of what I study. And one of the things to think about when we're thinking through those is there are certain tropes, as Fatima was talking about, that are repeated constantly within these moral panics. And as we look at them and map them I mean, they definitely existed before 9/11, but the frequency and the intensity with which they have been operating since 9/11 is really increased. So some of the ways that we can look, that we can sort of think about them is to see the kinds of tropes that are repeated and in all of the, and are present in all of them and across national boundaries. So one of the things that is repeated in all of them is the idea that Muslim women are the perpetually persecuted. Shireen Razak calls this category the imperiled Muslim woman. So I think about so that Muslim women are not only imperiled or perpetually persecuted, but are inherently infantilized. So many of these moral panics take place around how the state or the exalted citizen subject must intervene, must stand up and intervene to save the rights and to save the bodies and the integrity of Muslim women who cannot be trusted to speak for themselves or cannot be trusted to have their own agency on this issue. So we see that repeated constantly, and definitely in my master's degree, I studied the Sharia discourse in Ontario, and that was one of the key tropes that we could see during that time. The second trope that that we can see repeated quite a bit is the idea that, and it's the twin characterization of the previous, so if Muslim women are perpetually persecuted, then Muslim men are gendered and racialized as being relentlessly oppressive. And the sexism of Muslim men then gets really contrasted and sort of exalted above all other sexism, all other misogyny in any other community. And it's it works in a very profound way, and we've seen this repeated multiple times, including in the as a way to mobilize for war. So it's only against this image, this trope of the Muslim man being relentlessly oppressive, that George Bush and Mitt Romney get to construct themselves as feminists, which I think is a fabulous trick. And it works really effectively. It actually gets people to think about bombing and torture chambers as noble feminist endeavors. And it's been a very profoundly effective thing. And one of the reasons it works is that these tropes are not just held on the right, but they're held and believed on the left as well. And so they cross those lines. We also see this in the way in which war is critiqued. So we think of war, when we critique war, we think of it, well, you know, it didn't really do its job. Like, it didn't really liberate women, it didn't really bring democracy, which of course emphasizes and reinforces the problematic idea that that's how we get democracy. We bombed places, and that's how democracy gets there. The third trope that I want to talk about is the way in which Muslim societies, Muslim majority societies, and Muslim communities in the West get constructed as barbarians, as invaders at the gate, that are constantly... we're good at that right now. Thanks. And the Muslim community in Canada gets denationalized. We saw this in the Sharia debate, but in all sorts of debates, it becomes this kind of policing of the national boundary, policing of the real citizen from the threat and the savage barbarian threat, the body that is not only out of place but is out of history, that is a pre-modern body that cannot be recuperated, cannot be reclaimed, and then discourse really is around policing the parameters of the toxic influence of said body. So we can see that this is in media, and like this is easy to recognize when you sort of follow the media, watch Fox News for 5 minutes, or any of these things. But anybody catch the last, the third presidential, U.S. presidential debate? Good times. So that pretty much was a pissing contest of how many Muslims can I kill? And how many Muslims do I want to kill? And I want to kill more Muslims than you want to kill. And that's why I should get to be president. It was fun times, really great for my blood pressure watching that. But that's basically very normalized discourse in the U.S. And another example of that is last year when Harper was asked, what is the largest global threat? And his answer was Islam, or Islamist. I can't remember how he phrased it, but that's the largest threat. So the idea that there's this existential threat, and, you know, a little comical, when you think about the concentration of wealth, power, and armament, and the fear that is also attached in that area. It's quite hilarious. and these moral panics, like I said, increasing in frequency and intensity. So I wanted to talk about two recent examples and look at social memes that sort of, Isaac, do you want to? Awesome. I'm just going to get you to flip through them for me. Thank you. So I'm just going to look at two. So the first one that we see is Muslim Rage, and from this cover, which was September 24th, the Newsweek cover. I hear Newsweek is going under. So sad. So this cover was, and it was in the article is about the protests that were worldwide around a YouTube video, an Islamophobic YouTube video. Can you switch to the next slide, Issa? So to compare it, this is a cover from Newsweek from 1985. Now, those of us who are old enough and remember the 1980s, really, when we think of the 1980s in South Africa, we really think of black violence and white reforms. Really, because Newsweek, always on the right side of history. Next slide. So once they published this, they put a gambit out on Twitter to get people to discuss the cover. And so they sort of started the hashtag Muslim Rage. Go ahead. So these are some of the ads. And so very quickly, that hashtag was subverted by people from all over the world tweeting with wit and humor, trying to subvert the hashtag. Next. And these are some images that were tweeted. And again, just supplanting the picture of the cover. And there was another hashtag that was started called hashtag Muslim Rager with pictures of Muslim partying. Does anybody get the joke in this?
It's very hard to read the little tell, so if you can do that for us.
Oh, it just says it's the same as the cover, so it says how I survived it and how we can end it. That's just the Newsweek cover. They're just supplanting the images. So this is a very inside joke, so I don't think unless you're Muslim, you don't get that joke, and I'm not going to explain it here, so I'll just move right on. This is less funny, but it's also an internal joke, and I thought it shows some kind of internal confidence to have these put these jokes out there. This is just people getting pissed off at the bad parking at the mosque. Also, more of an internal joke, apparently. Nobody's laughing. Go ahead. this is another one. Not so funny. There's lots to be said about this, and I think it speaks to some kind of vibrancy and a collective response, which I think is really wonderful, and we need to celebrate. But I also want to caution around the differential of power that's involved in this kind of a collective response versus the kind of power dominant media has to frame the discourse. So the next thing I want to look at is an ad that was taken out in the New York City subway system, in the transit system. So the next one. So these posters were put all over the subway system and on buses in New York City, and it was taken out by a group called the American Freedom Defense Initiative. It's a pretty intense ad, and it was initially the MTA or whatever transit authority there is in New York City had wanted to not run the ads, but they took it to court and it became a freedom of speech issue. And of course, freedom of speech is what speech you can pay for. And so they were able to run these ads. This is just a shot of it on alongside a bus. And anybody been to New York City? Massive population of Muslims and people of color, racialized bodies in New York City. So imagine the affective response of riding the train when your body is red in this kind of way. So these are some responses to the ad, both things that were tweeted and things that were physically done. What's that? You can do that, right?
In her debut novel, Pam Geller brings new meaning to the clash of civilizations.
So this was a flyer put out by a local group that was made to look like one of the ads, like one of the safety ads put out by the Transit Authority. And then there was a campaign of people posting or putting these stickers and defacing or enhancing the ads all through the New York City system. So these are, I've taken this off the internet, and these are above is listed where, what subway stations they could be found in. And the next set are text tweets that were tweeted.
What?
This is, ICNA is the Islamic Circle of North America, so it's a national Muslim organization. I put that up. So, and there's literally countless more. These are just what I could pull off the internet after breakfast today. So, and I think it's inspiring. I was very inspired. I was really taken by these community responses. And there was many other types of responses. There were interfaith groups in New York City who held press conferences in the subway stations to denounce this kind of ideology, and there was many other ways that the community responded. And I think that those need to be celebrated, and particularly to see these responses, these social memes, as a tenacity, as a vibrancy, as a sign of a community not refusing to be silent. And by community, I mean the larger community of people who don't like to hate, that community. So I think that there's something really wonderful about that. But I also really want to say that there's no way that that can compete with the kind of dominant paradigm. And I think that there's still a long way to go before we can sort of say that there is equal power between these paradigms. And the kind of constant repetitious and the kind of normative way in political discourse in the States, and increasingly so in Canada, where there is no space for a Muslim body in the public sphere. There is no space for, in fact, when being a Muslim is an accepted slur that politicians have to distance themselves from or defend themselves from, that there's a long road to go, and that the dominant narrative and the way in which it is framed still consistently puts Muslims outside of the nation and outside of history. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.